Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. U.S. President is the only office in our country where you can get more votes in an election and still lose the presidency, lose that office. In fact, it's happened a number of times in our country's history. Very recently, it's happened in two out of the last five presidential elections when the candidate who became president was not the one most Americans voted for. Today, we want to discuss why our founding fathers created the Electoral College to elect presidents instead of relying on a direct popular vote, which puts our other office holders in their seats. We'll go back to the 1800s, also to more recent history, to examine instances where the merits of our Electoral College system were called into question. Joining us to do that, presidential historian Tim Walch, retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum and Library. Hi again, Tim.
Good to be with you, Ben.
And Carrie Covington at the University of Iowa Political Science of the University of Iowa Political Science Department. Welcome to you as well, Carrie.
I'm glad to be here.
And I just love these shows where we take current circumstances and understand them in a whole different way, past the headlines, the analysis, to reach back decades or even hundreds of years to find out how this is embedded in the founding of our country. If you'd like to join our conversation this hour as we discuss the Electoral College, we'll also discuss a little bit later movements, current movement after the last election, as you can imagine. Some people saying it's all old, it needs to be changed, we shouldn't have the Electoral College anymore. 1-866-780-9100. Trying to figure out where we came from, where we are now, and where this may be headed in the future. Let's start, if we could, with you, Tim Walch. What are the origins of the Electoral College? And to the question of the founding fathers, what were they thinking?
Well, let's start with the term. Electoral College does not appear in the Constitution. The word electors does. And it was an effort on the part, as I understand it, and Carrie can correct me, to basically control the process of how we would select a president, not giving in to the mob. Hamilton once referred to the voting populace as a great beast. And so the idea was that perhaps we would have the legislative branch select the president. Mm-hmm. And out of the Virginia plan, you have this idea of having a limited selection process that would include the selection of electors in individual congressional districts. So the idea would be that voters would, in effect, cast a vote for somebody that they knew, who then they would trust to select the president of the United States. And that was, I think, the intent, certainly by Hamilton and Madison, in the Federalist Papers, that the expectation would be that we would select individuals who then would choose our presidents. Why would we not then, as some people would say, have a popular sovereignty, one person, one vote? Well, in effect, because when we established the Constitution, we were counting slaves as a portion of the population for purposes of representation in the House of Representatives, but we were not counting them in terms of how they would be calculated in terms of the vote. So that added to the problem of who was going to select presidents of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Carrie Covington, add to this, and yet this is the only office, as I mentioned at the outset, which we do not elect directly by popular vote. This one was excluded.
Right. Another way to think about it is who did the founders see as being stakeholders in the government? And if you look at Congress, you'll see that in their original thinking, the voters were stakeholders because they elected members to the House of Representatives. The states were stakeholders in the sense that they elected senators. And so when it came to the president, they really had a hard time figuring out how to choose the president. They considered having the voters do it. They considered having the Congress do it. And there were fundamental flaws with each of those. The Electoral College emerged more as a best outcome because it isn't the other two that of the people who were considered sort of the best politicians at the convention were slotted with that responsibility. People like Ben Franklin find a way to choose a president that doesn't make the people the chooser and doesn't make the Congress the chooser. And that's what they came up with, was this indirect election system where states choose electors and electors choose the presidents and the people choose the state legislatures. So they wanted us at a distance. The founders were worried about, as Tim suggested, Hamilton describes the mob, they were worried about direct election, a plebiscitary type of president. But they also did not want Congress choosing the president, because that would undo the principle of separation of powers. And so this was kind of the least bad solution.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kerry, was it always the case, where are electors bound to, as they are now, bound to vote for the constituency's choice?
Well, the premise of your question is wrong. They're not bound. Just in the last election, we had 7 what we call faithless electors who didn't vote.
Faithless electors. That's a great title to have.
Right. Yes. And we normally do not have faithless electors, because the electors are chosen based on their party loyalty for the most part. And so it's a brave person who is vested with this by their party and then turn their back on the party. So it doesn't happen often. There was one during the 2000 election, and there were 7 in 2016. But, they're not bound. That's actually the point. Now, some states, each state makes its own rules. And so some states have different kinds of penalties, or they will even invalidate an elector if they vote contrary to the state's wishes. But this is a state-by-state process, and the rules vary. The Congress and the Constitution don't speak to binding electors in any way.
Okay, we're talking about the Electoral College this hour in historical context. Kerry Covington with us of the University of Iowa. Tim Walsh, presidential historian. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Well, most recently we know, in most of the living memory of those listening and those participating, certainly the year 2000 was a year in which the popular vote winner did not end up in the White House. Also, our most recent presidential election, 2016, Donald Trump got 2% less of the popular vote than Hillary Clinton did, some 2.9 million votes, the difference there. Unless you ask President Trump, he would give you a different version of that without any evidence, we have to say, as well. George W. Bush attained the White House after losing the popular vote by 0.5 percentage point. But we have instances, and we'll talk about those a little bit later, but Tim, take us back to the 1800s, other less well-known instances when the Electoral College was really focused on and perhaps the theory of how it would work did not match up with the practice.
Well, in 1824, you have the first of these events when John Quincy Adams, Henry Clay, and Andrew Jackson are running for president. When you divide it, the electoral vote by 3, it is often the case that no one candidate will get a majority of the electoral votes, and that throws the election into the House of Representatives. And that was the initial controversy that's provided for by the Constitution. And so then deals were worked out between Clay and John Quincy Adams, and Adams was selected president, although Jackson had more electoral votes at the time. Now, of course,
more popular votes.
Excuse me?
More
popular votes. Thank you.
Both.
Yes. So what you have is a situation where when you have 3 candidates, you often are dividing the electoral votes in different ways. 1876, Samuel Tilden achieves a majority of the popular vote, but loses the electoral vote because of the way the vote is distributed. And so if you remember, you're winning by state. So the real goal is not merely to accumulate the largest number of votes nationwide. The goal is to win each of those individual states so that you have all of their electors. And that's what President Trump did when he had more votes in, say, Wisconsin and Ohio and Pennsylvania. And that, in effect, those 30 or 40,000 votes made the difference.
Right. And people claiming after the 2016 election saying, well, the popular vote winner should have won. And those who backed Trump said, hey, wait a minute. Then you're changing the rules of the game after the game.
Sure.
We were focused on, as you say, the electoral votes in each individual
exactly,
state.
Exactly. Because our elections, remember, our country is named the United States of America. And the word states is important. So the elections, although they're for our national leader, are taking place on a state-by-state basis. And in most states, as Kerry suggested, we have faithful electors. Those electors are selected by each party. If the Republican candidate wins, then the Republican electors will go to the state house in December and vote, cast their electoral vote for Donald Trump or the Republican candidate. And except for Maine and Nebraska, where they do it by congressional district, generally you take the whole state. So it's a winner-take-all situation.
Kerry, I wanted to ask you about the 1824 election because we said there are three people there. They didn't attain the majority of the electoral votes. And we have as a theme today that, you know, the constant complaint over the last decades is why do we only have two parties? I don't like the candidate in either party. Let's have another party. Is the Electoral College part of the reason why we only have two major parties?
It certainly is. There's a little bit of a wrinkle in the 1824 election, which is there was a fourth candidate named Crawford who actually beat Clay in the Electoral College vote. And that was important because if Clay had been in the top three, he would have been eligibly chosen by the House. And as Speaker of the House, he would have whipped the House into voting him into presidency ahead of Adams and Jackson. So the fact that there was a fourth candidate that kept Clay from being considered then enabled Clay as a consolation prize to work an arrangement with Adams so that he would then become Secretary of State, which at that time in our history was sort of the stepping stone to the presidency. But the problem with having multiple candidates when there's only one office is the losers are closer to each other ideologically than they are to the winner. I think the better election to look at for that is 1912, where you have Taft and Teddy Roosevelt splitting the Republican vote and allowing a Democrat to win the presidency.
Woodrow Wilson.
Woodrow Wilson. Prior to Wilson, there's only one Democrat elected president since the Civil War, and that's Grover Cleveland. He's got elected twice, but it's an era dominated by the Republicans, and after Wilson, there's another three Republican presidents. So the Republicans, you know, shot themselves in the foot when they allowed themselves to be split into the Roosevelt and Taft factions. And so, yes, if you have three parties, the party with the most votes is going to be the one farthest from the other two, which means the other two to combined probably are a majority.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why they have to make their peace. They have to find a way of unifying so there's just a unified front against whatever the other party's offering.
University of Iowa Associate Professor of Political Science Kerry Covington joining us by phone. Presidential historian Tim Walsh in our Iowa City studio talking about the history of the Electoral College. Two out of the past five presidential elections, the candidate who became the president was not the one most Americans voted for. So we're sort of picking apart where this system came from and putting it to the test. After the last election, California Senator Barbara Boxer said, "The Electoral College is an outdated, undemocratic system that does not reflect our modern society and needs to change immediately." Now, that could be interpreted as sour grapes after the election from the Democratic senator from California. Interesting, when we talk about the popularity of the Electoral College in modern times, I don't know if either of you have looked at support or the popularity of the Electoral College, but correct me if I'm wrong, it seems that different polls reveal different things. And when the most interesting poll is a lot of them were taken in December or late November of 2016, of course, after our latest election. And the degree to which you like the Electoral College was reflected by what? Your politics.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, what party you were in said whether you liked the Electoral College or not. Kerry, have you looked into that at all?
Well, I mean, there's certainly truth to that. But if you look historically at the amendments proposed to the Constitution, 10% of the proposed amendments to the Constitution revolve around changing the Electoral College. And if you look at the amendments, we have several that change the Electoral College. So there's an abiding historical dissatisfaction with the way we do it, because there's this tension. As Tim suggested, earlier in our history, states were seen as independent actors with interests. And over time, we came to think of ourselves more as a nation. To me, the most interesting way of seeing that is, as Tim said, we're the United States, plural of America. If you look before before the Civil War, most uses of the word United States of America was used as a plural noun. Mm-hmm. So the states are doing something. And the Civil War was a kind of unifying event that led people to think first of themselves as citizens of the nation. And so after that time, United States of America is increasingly used as a singular noun. So the United States is doing something.
And unless you listen to the BBC World Service, I still think they say the Army are. And I think you will still catch them saying the United States are.
Interesting.
I'm surprised they don't say the colonies.
Let's talk a little bit about the pros and cons, in theory and in practice, of it. What do we see as the advantages of having electoral college?
One of the advantages, and a large one coming from a state the size of Iowa, is that all of the states have a representation then in the election of the president, because, of course, you have to win these individual states. You can't merely try to sweep into office by winning just the states on the West Coast and the East Coast, where there's heavy population density. So you really do have to win the Dakotas and Iowa and seek representation in the middle part of the country and listen to what people have to say. There's a fear that if you went by strict popular sovereignty, that certainly advertising and appearances and campaigning would be strictly limited to the high density states, and that the middle parts of the country would be ignored. It would all be done by, where's the majority of the people.
And the flip side of that is that if you live in other certain states, your vote, so to speak, counts less.
Oh, absolutely.
If you are a Republican in California, well, how much does your vote matter? Well, if you are a Democrat in West Virginia,
that's right.
How much does your vote matter?
I mean, you get three electoral votes I think each of the Dakotas has three electoral votes individually. Okay, I think that there's fewer people in either of the Dakotas than there would be, say, in Los Angeles County, California. So the bottom line is you have a dense population in California, but they are represented by congressional districts. I think they have 55 congressional districts. So they do have a sizable number of electoral votes. But in terms of percentage and proportion, those smaller states have greater weight, because there's a certain minimum in terms of the number of electoral votes each individual state would have, because it's by, congressional district, and each of those states is a single congressional district, plus the two members of the Senate, so that would be three as a minimum.
Mm-hmm. So can I bring, as the political scientist, can I bring some numbers to these things?
Oh, yes.
For sure. Numbers.
So it's interesting to me that people talk about, we would pay attention to the coast and not to the Midwest, as if we pay attention to everybody more equally today. But if you look at the 2016 election, 57% of the candidate visits during the election were focused on four states. And those four states had 15% of the electoral votes. Where the candidates focus isn't geography; it's whether the state is open to be won. If you take California, Texas, New York, and Illinois in 2016, they have 26% of the electoral vote between them. And they got less than one half of 1% of the candidate visits in the entire time.
They are written off by one party
because,
or the other.
Yeah, they're blue or red. And, you're absolutely right.
And if you talk about money, and I don't have the money for 2012, but in 2012, 40 of the states had less than one half of 1% of campaign spending conducted in their boundaries. 10 states had 99.6% of all the campaign spending done in their state. We focus on the battleground states, the purple states, the swing states, and everybody else is ignored. Yeah. So now if a flyover state happens to be competitive, like in Iowa, then it'll get attention. But if a flyover state isn't competitive, like a Dakota, nobody cares what they think, because we already know how they're going to vote, and they'll vote their way regardless of whether we compete there or not. So it's interesting. I mean, the money's going to be focused. The candidates are going to be focused somewhere. Right now, they focus on the states that are competitive. Under a different system, they'll focus on a different consideration.
Okay, let's go to a caller before our break. Chris is joining us from Iowa City. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind in regards to the Electoral College in this discussion?
Well, we were talking about, or you guys were talking about history and sort of the Connecticut Compromise and how smaller states like Delaware and Maryland, they really pushed for the Senate being chosen by the states because they felt that states needed to have a say in that process. I'm sort of curious what the panel thinks the founders would have maybe come up with had they known that, you know, later on we were going to make it so that the Senate was directly elected.
Okay. Who wants to tackle that?
I think Hamilton would be appalled. But
he'd be appalled.
I mean, that's just a guess. Well, because I think there's an apprehension against about popular sovereignty in general, I think, in the 18th century. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that you're selecting groups of people who would then make the decisions on behalf of the larger group. I don't know. Carrie, what do you think?
Right. Yeah, I mean, the whole move of making the states directly elected was as a result of the progressive movement, which generally wanted to increase the role of the popular vote. That's why they wanted to bring in the primaries in the nominating process. They wanted the people to do the choosing. The founders had a very different idea, which is the House of Representatives is where the people get to speak, and they get to feed their desires into the government every 2 years. And so the House is like this pulsating, hot source of public opinion, and then the Senate and the President are there to calm it down, to cool it off, to smooth out the rough edges so that the policies are not divisively majoritarian in nature, but rather take into account a variety of different interests. Mm-hmm. So I think the founders would be very disappointed in the states having direct election of the Senate. I think the founders would be very apprehensive of direct election of the president. They clearly were worried the president would get the upper hand in a system of checks and balances if the president were directly elected, and they did not want that to happen.
Interesting. Okay, we'll be back in just a moment. We're going to continue our discussion about the Electoral College in historical context. Two out of the past five presidential elections now in the beginning of the, I guess, 2000. Was that the beginning of the 21st century? Was that the first year?
That's right.
Okay, I know that's debated, too. Two out of the past five elections, the 2000 election and the 2016 election, the candidate who became president was not the one most Americans voted for. We're looking at other instances in U.S. history. Perhaps we have something to finish up in the 19th century. Otherwise, we'll move on to the 20th century. We'll see what we have from our presidential historian, Tim Walch, and our political scientist, Carrie Covington. Perhaps you'll join our conversation as well as we discuss the question of, well, has the Electoral College outlived its usefulness? Is the difference between what they theorized as their founding fathers and the practice really so out of kilter that it needs to be changed? And we'll talk about a movement currently to change it when we come back. Back with Tim Walch and Carrie Covington. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with the University of Iowa political scientist Carrie Covington, presidential historian Tim Walch. We're talking about the Electoral College. Why? Well, because in the last five presidential elections, two of them, the candidate who has became president in two of those was not the one most Americans voted for. Most recently, Hillary Clinton, the fifth presidential candidate in history to win the popular vote in the U.S. and lose the Electoral College. She got, according to the official results, some 2.9 million more votes than Donald Trump. Of course, the popular vote was not the game that was being played. The game, if you want to say it that way, very important game, was winning the electoral votes that are accorded to each state, and they are part of the Electoral College. That's what we're talking about this hour. The degree to which the Electoral College meets the theoretical framework set down by our founding fathers, their worries, their concerns of a directly elected president, the degree to which that has panned out in practice or been panned, we could say, by many people these days. And we'll hear from one of those people in just a moment. But we're getting to the end of the 19th century. Tim Walz, we haven't talked about an election, 1888. Tell us how the Electoral College figured in there. There's another one where the popular vote did not elect the president.
Exactly. The popular vote went to Grover Cleveland, who was president of the United States at the time. He'd finished his first term. But the election was so close between the Republican Benjamin Harrison and Cleveland, and Harrison actually won the Electoral College and therefore won the election. Now, of course, that changed with the next election because Cleveland won his second term, and it often causes a certain measure of confusion because Grover Cleveland is both, I think, the 22nd and the 24th president of the United States because his two terms are divided by that one term of Harrison. But it also indicates, that going back to 1876 and 1888, how close the elections were in some of those elections. Kerry is right. The Republicans tended to win, and except for Cleveland, who was the exception, but there also were some very close elections, particularly in certain battleground states like Indiana, Ohio, and New York.
Mm-hmm. Hard to believe that the year 2000 is 18 years behind us, but wasn't that a year to live through politically, an election to live through? Kerry Covington, would you walk us through that election? Remind us, those of us who paid attention to politics, remember it as a time of tumult, and just what is going on here? How many weeks did we go not knowing really for sure who would be the president?
Yeah, I don't have particular numbers with me, but I do remember how it was protracted, and it was confused because Al Gore initially conceded, and then he withdrew his concession, and it went down to the state of Florida and came down to the mechanics of casting one's vote and what counts as a vote for a candidate and what doesn't. And so the phrase hanging Chad entered into our lexicon.
Oh, did we talk a lot about hanging Chads?
as voters were pushing buttons or pins that were supposed to puncture a card, and did they puncture it or didn't they, and do you count the vote or not, that led to a big push to reform our election procedures and create electronic voting, which now has become the target of Russian meddling in some circles, that Russians are trying to meddle with our electronic voting. So no system works perfectly. But it certainly was a back and forth, and Gore goes to court, and he wants to have votes recounted. He chooses to only challenge the vote in certain counties rather than in the state of Florida as a whole, and that's seen as problematic.
Isn't that the mistake? Had he gone for the entire state of Florida, would the outcome have been different?
Well, the court decision might have been a little bit different. The interesting thing about the Bush v. Gore decision that the Supreme Court handed down is that in the decision, they specifically stated that this decision has no precedential authority. That is, no other case in the future can ever go to this court as expressing why the government should make some decision in the future. So this was a one-off decision that is only going to apply to this case. What I like to point out to people is that the Florida State Legislature was at work at the same time as the courts and the election officials, and the Republican legislature, which was controlled by the Republicans, had made it known that if the court decision went against Bush, that they would reclaim the power to choose the electors to themselves and choose a Republican slate. So in a sense, this was all kind of a charade, because the Republican legislature was not going to allow the Democratic electors to be chosen.
Right.
Now,
right.
whether that would have been upheld in the courts is another question. But it goes back to what the Constitution tells us. There is no binding. There is no rule. It's simply up to the state legislatures to decide how to choose the electors. And the state legislatures have universally said the voters should do it. But they can change their mind.
Right. And in taking us back to the feeling of that time, the sentiment, Tim Walsh, perhaps you can do that. The idea as this went on that we were having a constitutional crisis, we right. were, as a country, feeling more and more on edge what is going to happen. So that was weighing on Al Gore's
sure.
mind, wasn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. I mean, I think Al Gore, in conceding, reflected the overwhelming spirit or feeling of the American people as they just wanted it to be over.
Let's listen to part of that concession speech after the contentious election and debated outcome. Vice President Al Gore conceding to George Bush in the 2000 election. A bit of sound from that speech.
I know that many of my supporters are disappointed. I am too. But our disappointment must be overcome by our love of country. And I say to our fellow members of the world community, let no one see this contest as a sign of American weakness. The strength of American democracy is shown most clearly through the difficulties it can overcome. Some have expressed concern that the unusual nature of this election might hamper the next president in the conduct of his office. I do not believe it need be so. President-elect Bush inherits a nation whose citizens will be ready to assist him in the conduct of his large responsibilities. I personally will be at his disposal, and I call on all Americans. I particularly urge all who stood with us to unite behind our next president. This is America. Just as we fight hard when the stakes are high, we close ranks and come together when the contest is done.
Vice President Al Gore conceding that in the year 2000. Listening to those words, Tim Walsh, you have to wonder if that would come about now in this day and age, a couple decades later, when everything is fought for tooth and nail.
You're absolutely right. The acrimony and bitterness of our elections now is not reflected, obviously, in the words, the civic virtue that Al Gore was expressing in those comments, because he is saying that we do struggle and fight through a political campaign, but when it becomes evident we need to resolve it, we do, and we graciously then concede the election, which is what he did for the good of the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple of things about that. One is, what was so stunning about this election was that, as far as people were concerned, it had never happened before. As Tim pointed out, 1888 is the last time it happened. So it's a fluke. It's bizarre. We don't know how to cope with this, and so that made it very controversial. But it wasn't delegitimating because it's not something that happened on a regular basis. And the other thing to keep in mind, as some analysts said, the American people flipped a coin between Bush and Gore, and it ended on its side. You know, it ended on its edge. It landed on edge. The vote differential between the two is really tiny in terms of the total vote. And so the idea that Gore somehow won is based on this, you know, very close reading of the popular vote. That's very different than 2016. 2016, Hillary Clinton wins by almost 3 million votes, and it's now the second time in 5 elections that this is happening. And so the urgency felt by people about, is this the right way to choose our presidents, is much more serious in 2016 than it was in 2000. 2000 was a kind of a curiosity. It was a glitch, in a sense. You know, it happens once a century. We can live with it. Happens once, you know, twice every 5 elections, 40% of the time. Now we have to reconsider whether we want to change our system or not.
Kerry Covington, Tim Walsh with us. Tim Walsh, presidential historian, political scientist. Kerry Covington, finishing up our hour talking about the Electoral College. We still have a good 10 minutes left. An email from Kerry: I'd like to hear any perspective your guests may wish to offer regarding initiatives advocated by fairvote.org, the National Popular Vote for President. Let's get to that in a minute. Okay. Before that, let's talk about the constitutional amendment that could change this. How would you go about it? The process of changing it. This is a workaround we're going to talk about in just a moment. But Tim Walsh, how, and has it been tried in history? How would you go about it changing it, let's say, properly through the Constitution, a constitutional change?
In 1968, I think it was, certainly the late 60s, Senator Birch Bayh of Indiana and Emanuel Seller, a congressman from New York, introduced a proposed amendment to change to popular sovereignty. And it didn't go very far. I think it was, again, the result of an election in 68, which was divided not just between Humphrey and Nixon in terms of electoral votes, but also George Wallace. So the intent was to reconsider the whole process of amending the Constitution to allow for popular sovereignty, to the popular vote to determine. And I know back in the 1970s, Jimmy Carter proposed amendments. It doesn't seem to get much traction. It would have to pass both houses of Congress, of course, and then it would have to be ratified by, three-quarters of the states, Kerry? I can't remember.
Yeah, three-fourths of the states. And that's so why it's never going
to
happen.
Yeah, they'd have to give up. It would be against their own best interest to give up that kind of authority, and you're talking about all those decisions. So it's very difficult to amend the Constitution unless you have an overwhelmingly popular incentive or initiative to do so. The last change to the Electoral College, I think, was it the 23rd Amendment, when we allowed the District of Columbia to have three electoral votes. So we have 538 electoral votes.
Have we always allowed states to divvy up their electoral votes proportionally if they wish to, Kerry?
Sure. States can do it any way they want.
But it's only a small handful that do that, right?
Only two states, Nebraska and I think Maine, mm-hmm. vote on the basis of districts, and then two go to whoever gets the most votes. And the reason everybody goes with the winner-take-all system is, again, it maximizes their clout in the Electoral College. If I'm a swing state and you pick up 1 or 2% of the vote, you pick up 100% of the Electoral College vote. And so every state, except for Nebraska and Maine, go winner-take-all to maximize their impact.
Let's talk about the avenue open to correct this system, if you feel it needs to be corrected. Mentioned by that email from Kerry, one of our listeners, it's the National Popular Vote Compact, a state-based attempt to abolish the Electoral College by allocating electoral votes to the popular vote winner. Former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich is a big fan of this. He's been putting out a lot of information online. Here's part of an online video he did explaining how he thinks people could work around the Electoral College.
So all that's needed is for states with a total of at least 270 electors to agree to award all their electoral votes to the presidential candidate who wins the popular vote. If they do that, then automatically the winner of the popular vote gets the 270 electoral votes he or she needs to become president. Already, 10 states and the District of Columbia have passed laws to do exactly this, awarding all their electoral votes to the candidate who wins the popular vote as soon as the 270 elector goal is met. Together, these states total 165 electoral votes. So all we need now is some additional states with 105 electors to pass the same law, agreeing to reward all their electoral votes to the winner of the popular vote. And it's done. We'll never again elect a president who loses the popular vote.
Okay. Robert Reich there. He has, I don't have to mention, very entertaining little videos on the web, and you heard a lot of bells and whistles there. That's what those are about. So Kerry, nothing needs to change in our Constitution. The
right.
States have it in their hands to do this without any constitutional change.
Well, in principle, that's correct. And states enter into interstate compacts all the time. There are interstate compacts that govern pollution in the Mississippi River, for instance, where states cooperate. There are interstate cooperation on the East Coast to control air pollution. So it's not an unheard-of practice. I just do not think it's any more likely than amending the Constitution, because when push comes to shove, there's no enforcement mechanism in such an agreement. And when a state is faced with voting for a candidate opposite the one that their own voters voted for, that is signing your own political death warrant. You're committing political suicide, and every elected official in that state who is responsible will lose the next election. So I just don't think it's enforceable. I don't think states, when push comes to shove, will have the political nerve to sustain it. And if I can't trust everybody else to follow the rule, then I'm not going to follow the rule. So I think it's kind of wishful thinking. It goes contrary to all the political realities that govern our system.
Former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich doesn't seem to think it defies political realities. He's been on this show a couple of times.
But he is not an elected official. Right. He's never been elected to anything.
But he's part of he's a former administration official. But I just have to ask after your comments, Kerry, why would someone like Robert Reich and a host of other people with a lot of credibility put this forward as a possibility if it is really not going to happen?
Right.
Or doesn't it?
Well, because they've bought into the premise that electing the president is a majoritarian action of the people. And as I say, that has become the dominant view. The people who defend the idea that states are entities that should be casting votes because they're states, there are very few people who really buy into that, and when they do, it's because their candidate won the election. I like to say that dirt doesn't vote. Why should a state with a lot of land and no people have more vote than a state with little land and a lot of people? People don't put their identity in states the way they used to, and so folks who think of us as a nation of one people, see no reason for the states to mess it up. And so this is a way to get the voice of the people respected in the choice of the president.
Yeah, absolutely. Kerry's dead on right in the sense that people who accept the premise of popular sovereignty, that we are all Americans and one person, one vote, would find this kind of a compact an intriguing idea, and that people of good virtue would, of course, embrace it because they also embrace popular sovereignty. But if your view is to ensure by every legal means that your candidate for your party wins the election, you're not going to vote against your best interest just because you believe in popular sovereignty. So I'm not sure that people would honor the compact.
Whether you have a compact or not.
There's nothing to hold them to that compact.
Right.
They could change the law, withdraw from the compact.
Right.
You know, if you were a deep red state and some previous legislature had accepted the compact. I think, in a way, what Robert Reich does is a kind of a – he's a provocateur. He wants to stimulate ideas and discussion, and it's an intriguing idea. And Kerry's right. There are other compacts that states enter into, but in most cases, it's mutually beneficial.
Right.
In a case where you're going to elect as president somebody who won the popular vote but was not representative of your party – You're signing your own political death warrant.
Sounds like the two of you could send off a pair of rose-colored glasses to Robert Reich.
His videos are wonderful, and they're very entertaining, regardless of whether you agree with what he has to say. And he's stimulating, and there's value in that, but I don't think it's realistic.
Are there other avenues that we haven't explored, Kerry, in terms of what might be tweaked here to avoid the instances where people feel their vote or the nation's vote did not get reflected well?
Well, I mean, there are, but they come with their own problems. We could pass a law. Congress can pass laws supervising the states on elections, like the Civil Rights Act in 65, or the Voting Rights Act, rather. But we could require, I mean, it might not pass constitutional muster, but we could require district-by-district voting, like Nebraska and Maine, with the idea that California's 55 votes don't all go Democratic, you know, maybe just 35 of them do, and the rest go Republican, and Texas 30-some votes don't all go Republican, but they go Democrat too, and that would level the playing field in the sense of getting candidates to compete in other places where they can pick up individual districts rather than having to win the whole state. The problem with that, which is evident in the 2000 election, is rather than fighting over one state, if it's really close, you now start fighting over dozens, and if not hundreds, of districts all across the country. Republicans in 2000 were promising to open up court challenges to state elections in like Arizona and New Mexico to offset any losses they might have faced in Florida. And when it's 51 voting units, that's manageable. But when it's 538 voting units, now you've got an entirely different kind of problem.
Okay, we've just about run out of time, a little less than a minute. I'm going to give that to Tim Walsh here to finish up with any concluding thoughts.
I just want to raise the whole question. First of all, this is a work in progress. And in fact, the founders, if they're speaking to us, have said, look, we worked in the summer of 1787. We put together the best possible plan we can. We understand this is going to change and evolve as circumstances dictate. And so nothing that we've written in the Constitution cannot be changed, but we do need to come to some common understanding. What this show has shown is that there's no clear, simple solution to the problem of how do we select president of the United States.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Presidential historian Tim Walsh, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum and Library, joined by University of Iowa Associate Professor of Political Science Carrie Covington. What a great team you make to put our current political times in historical context. Thank you, Carrie, and thank you, Tim.
Thank you.
Thanks.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Of course, we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime, and I can start learning to talk anytime. Email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.